Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Mallory's Weird World Adventures, the podcast. I'm your host, Mallory, and I'm here to show you just how weird this world of ours really is. So last time we talked about the Ice Age Trail in the southern west side of Germany, and specifically some of the incredible cave systems that are there and the wonderful artifacts that archaeologists have found within them. And now today I'm going to talk to you about the city of Ulm. This is specifically Albert Einstein's hometown, and it's also a relatively large city, but still the old town of Ulm is one of the most beautiful places you can see in Germany. Specifically, we started at the cathedral, and something that they gave us to note was that on December 18th, 1944, 80% of the city of Ulm was destroyed. So most of the original architecture of the city is gone. There is part of the old town that still remains that was somehow not damaged from that. And luckily, the cathedral did survive it. However, the windows blew out, so most of the windows from the original cathedral are no longer there. There are a few in the choir area in the back that are. Regardless, after World War II, specifically at the Ulm Cathedral, they decided to expand the space around the square of the church. And for some reason at that time, they thought it'd be a great idea to put in a parking area, which is a strange choice having, you know, a car park directly in front of the cathedral. It kind of takes away from the beauty of it. But they quickly found that the emissions from the car damaged the church. So instead of keeping that there, they got rid of that and then put a city house. So they built a new structure there. The tower of the cathedral here is specifically the highest church tower in the world. There's one planned in Barcelona that's supposed to be taller, but it's not built yet, so it's still the tallest. It's higher than the tower in Cologne. It's 165.5 meters tall. That is 542 feet tall. So it is quite large. Again, like I said, the highest church tower in the world. It was built over 500 years, with the construction starting in 1377. It was built because the town of Ulm had a lot of money, and because the old church was outside of the city walls of Ulm, so during times of war it was unsafe to go to church. And back during that time, people prayed five times a day, if not more, and there were ceremonies held at the church throughout the day, so it was a very important part of the civilization. It was much more frequently visited than it would be today for religious purposes, so the church being built inside the city was just a good idea practically too. So they started building the church then, and it was a project that I said lasted for over 500 years. It changed in appearance throughout different time periods, as many churches do. In 1492, stones fell down on a prayer circle from the ceiling because it wasn't well sustained and it started falling in on itself because they wanted it to be a very open church. And unfortunately, it was too open without any support. So stones started falling down in a prayer circle, and the people believed that the world might be ending because if you're praying and these stones are falling down on you, maybe God is angry at you. So that was, I'm sure, a very fun day that happened. So they had to repair it. So they built a tower hall and eventually pillars to keep everything in place. So it went from being this giant open spot that was planned to be larger than a football field, fully open, to being more like a traditional church with pillars because it was the only way to keep the structure up. I mean, that just makes sense. That's why pillars exist, right? It also is interesting anthropologically because it went from a Catholic church to a Protestant church, which is funny. It's happened quite a bit in Germany. I've been to Heidelberg, and there were also many churches there that kind of changed denomination. But this specifically went from Catholic to Protestant, and in this area, it's important for Protestant church, they don't really have photos of Jesus, whereas the Catholic church has altars and saints and Jesus and all of these elaborate artworks usually on display. So you can see these fainted paintings that are on the wall all throughout the cathedral, and it's because they painted over them when it became a Protestant church. And once people have realized that recently in the renovation efforts, they kind of helped to fade away the paint over it. So you can see these very faded old paintings that used to be quite vibrant, I'm sure, on the pillars and the walls back when it was a Catholic church. In the main chapel area, they have these beautiful sound covers over the speaking podium, and it's something you'll see in a lot of old churches where there's kind of this risen platform where the priest can go up on these steps into a slightly elevated area so everyone can see him or her, I guess. Him, if it's Catholic. Now there are some Protestant female priests, but anyway, you'll find these sound covers over these podiums, and they're these like dome-shaped, gold, elaborately carved kind of architectural things, domes, I guess, over top of the podium. And they are designed like that. Because back in the day, when there weren't microphones and the priest had to be heard throughout the entire church, it helped kind of manipulate the sound so that everyone would be able to hear them give the sermon. So they actually did serve a practical purpose. And they also, it's funny, this one in particular, they were telling us that it's so ornately carved. And it's, you can only see three sides of it because the fourth side is, up into the wall. But the sound cover here is ornately carved on all four sides, even the side you don't see, because even though people won't see it, God will see it. So it has to be perfect across the board. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then in the back of the church, in the choir area, that's where some of the original windows still stand. These windows specifically date back to 1425. And the 1400s was when the first ceremony was held there, and it was specifically in that spot that it was held in this church. The choir stools were built in 1474, and it's interesting because if you're looking at the back of the church and you're looking at the windows in this choir area, on the right side, it's specifically females carved into it, and it's like female, seers that are carved into the bottom part, and then there's a part that's risen, and it's specifically the women from the Old Testament, and then up above that is the women from the New Testament, people that were specifically mentioned in the Bible. And then on the left side, it's kind of the same setup but with men, except it was important historical figures at the time. So people that mattered to society then, that were famous philosophers that contributed to the history and art of the area, were carved into that side of the podium. And then above that is important male figures from the Old Testament, and then above that, important male figures from the New Testament. So that's kind of how it was set up. And those choir stools were for important people in the upper city. So about 10%, the upper 10%, and they had spots specifically in the choir. But if you had a spot there, it was one important because you got to actually lean when everyone else was standing, because this is before people sat to attend church, so everyone's standing. But these people are important enough where they have a spot to lean on. And however, if you're given one of those spots, you have to be there at all of the ceremonies throughout the day. So there's five ceremonies in a day. Back then. So you had to basically spend most of your day at the church on top of being an important figure to that civilization. So, it's the elite, the people that are in the, town hall, the people that are running things are not only doing that, but then they also have to attend five different church ceremonies a day. And they can't fall asleep because they have their little stool that they can lean on. And if they fell asleep, the stool would fall and make a loud crash. And then everyone would know that you just fell asleep during church and all the attention's on you. So it was really not a good thing. So, must have been quite complicated to attend that many church ceremonies a day. There were also death plates that were put around the back area there and throughout the church for when you lost a family member, you could put a plaque up to remember them with your family coat of arms. And The altar here was put back in for historical purposes because you won't find these altars in any other Protestant churches. Its altars are very Catholic in nature, but they actually went to find one, for anthropological reasons to have that there in the church because it's a piece of the church's history. Now, something that I loved about Ulm while we were spending the day there, this is the last thing I'll say about the church, but it also ties into the weird legends and stories that they hold in Ulm. And everywhere you go has their own local myths and legends. Well, one of them in Ulm is the sparrow. So people in Ulm consider themselves sparrows. It's like their mascot, like the town mascot is a sparrow. Why? Why is the town mascot a sparrow? Well, supposedly, when they were building the church, they had these giant sandstone blocks that make up the base of it, and they couldn't get these blocks through the halls of the city. They were too big, so they couldn't get them where they needed to be. And while they were perplexed and trying to figure out what they could do to solve this problem, they saw a sparrow try to go through this narrow spot, and it couldn't because its wingspan was too long. So after a moment, the sparrow thought about it and then flew through sideways and maneuvered his body a different way to fit through. And they thought, oh, we can just turn these stones to the side this way and then they'll fit through. Now, everyone pretty much knows that that's just a silly legend, and why wouldn't you think to just turn the rock? But regardless, the importance of the story rings true to the citizens of Ulm, and the sparrow is incredibly important to the town. You can see little sparrow details everywhere, and again, that's the mascot of their town. People call themselves their sparrows, which is interesting. And on the church, if you look up near the center, at the very top, there's this tiny, tiny, tiny little sparrow statue there to commemorate that story. So you'll see little accents like that, specifically related to sparrows, throughout Ulm. And then we moved on to the city hall, which is also another really interesting architectural structure. Back in the day, only about 10% of society, so it's the same 10% getting the good boxes of the church, 10% of the society was actually able to read. So the church had all these biblical stories on the walls and in the stained glass windows so people could decipher the stories that way. And the Bibles also weren't translated then, so they needed to have a visual representation of these stories to remind them. And the city hall was the same way, except with life virtues and guidelines. So they have these little scenes put up there explaining the laws and morality of the time so people could reference them by just looking at the city hall. And they also have an astronomical clock there. And I've seen the astronomical clock in Prague, by the way, and it's incredible. This one was just as ornately beautiful. It was really wonderful. And it has, the dates on it, of course, the sun, the moon, it has the dragon, all these different times to, tell you the zodiac, the astrological signs, what part of the astrological calendar we're in. And something that's really cool about it that I just can't get over is that it's set up so that when the dragon sign, the dragon on it goes over the sun and the moon, they all line up at the same time, there's a solar eclipse. And that's still true. They're still working. When there was the eclipse this past month, it lined up. People line up in the city hall to just see if it still works, and it still does. And it specifically symbolizes the fact that in many cultures, people believe that the dragon eats the moon and the sun, and everything goes dark. So the dragon covers it up and eats it, and everything's dark for a while. And it didn't used to be a good omen, but the clock was able to predict, and still is, whenever there's going to be a solar eclipse. Another scene depicted on the city hall is the Ulmer Box ship. This was the first city to load ships on the Danube River, so they had money. That's why Ulm had the money it did to build the church, was because they were trading and using the waterways before anyone else was. It was a huge trade hub, and they brought goods through countless areas of the Danube to the Swabian people. So they're known for having money there in Ulm for that specific reason. And that's another little scene there that's depicted on the back of the city hall. If you're walking from the city hall and you continue onward through one of the little walkways there in one of the alleys, you'll run into this waterway, which specifically has a hotel that is leaning far, 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 far over. It was built with the foundation partly in the water and partly on the land, which you can imagine was a recipe for disaster. You don't want to build over the river because the soil falls in, and that's what happened. So it is noticeably on this very distinct angle, and it was becoming more and more of a problem. And in the 1990s, an architect bought it and made it livable. He put in steel ropes inside to hold it up and specifically found a way to keep it kind of still tilted because that's part of the gimmick of what it is now, but safe and livable. And you also put cement down at the bottom so it's not going to continue to fall into the river. But you can stay there for the night. It's very hard to get a room there, so I'm told, because there's only 7 rooms and it's right there in the heart of the old town. And apparently it's still a little crooked in there because they said they had to have special furniture made for people to stay in there, which is pretty wild. But really cool looking. Then we got to talk about Albert Einstein. So there is a shop there in the old town of Ulm that still made it, that his grandparents and parents used to run. So his home was destroyed in the war, his birthplace, but the shop is still there. And they're actually going to open the shop in the next couple of years as a museum to Albert Einstein. So that's currently in the works, but today when we walked by, they had this Albert Einstein impersonator come out, and it was a trip. So Einstein means one stone. So this guy called himself Kindstein for no stones. And he gave a lot of good information about Albert Einstein, I will say. And then he ended it with this joke song about relativity, which was quite amusing that he played on a ukulele. That part was very amusing, but quite interesting. I guess they wanted to associate the fact that Albert Einstein did play the violin, but rather than having a violin in the violin case, they had a ukulele, because I guess this guy actor could play the ukulele, and he sang us the song of relativity. We walked out then to the city wall. The city wall is still there in Ulm on one side by the Danube River, and it's currently only there now because it's a good protection from flooding. And just recently, I told you that Germany had the worst rain they've had in quite a long time, and there's been a lot of flooding. So there was flooding in that area. It went all the way up the waterway, and the city wall did protect the city from damage from the rain. So it's doing its job. That's why it's there now. It's only half the size that it used to be because after they lost a battle with Napoleon, they had to lower it under his command. Ulm also has its own holiday. Again, this is another really cool, interesting part of Ulm that makes it special. It has its own holiday called Swear Monday, where the mayor swears to be a good mayor for the rich people and the poor people, which, hey, I respect that. That's pretty great. It's generally the last Monday of July, and it's a huge political day. It's a school holiday, and they have their own building with the balcony that's specifically made for this purpose, called the Swear Building. And the mayor will come out on the balcony and give a huge speech, and it's a big celebration and something that they do specifically here. That's something else I've noticed about Germany is that many areas have their own special holidays for just that area. This is just for Ulm. Just like, Carnival is not really like a new idea. I'm sure that, their civilizations have it everywhere. But in Germany, Cologne goes all out and celebrates Carnival for an entire week. It's a huge affair, and it's really just in the Cologne area, just like this Swear Day, Swear Monday, is just here in Ulm. And lastly, I learned something today that I'm definitely going to be writing an article about because I find this fascinating. So Germany had luxury laws back in medieval times. They're called sumptuary laws, and they were laws that tried to regulate consumption, but specifically it's defined as laws made for the purpose of restraining luxury or extravagance, particularly against inordinate expenditures for apparel, food, furniture, or shoes. Now, what does that mean? They basically put laws in place intended to regulate and reinforce social hierarchies. So they would tell you, based on your class system, what you are allowed to wear, what you are allowed to eat, and what you are allowed to spend your money on. So the nobility in Germany was allowed to wear Pine Marten furs, but they're the only ones that could. So you can look at old art photos and different things, and in that time you would know, well, this is a member of the nobility because he's wearing Pine Marten fur, and I'm not allowed to wear that because I'm a peasant. So it literally dictated what you could and couldn't wear and consume and live in based on your social status. That's how important the class systems were back at the time. Can you imagine being told what you are and aren't allowed to eat or buy or wear? Well, this person's of a higher status than you, so they're allowed to wear these different types of fabrics, but you can't because you are not as important as them. I mean, it just put things into perspective, I guess, how far we've come since that time. These laws specifically prevented common people from imitating the appearance of aristocrats. So that way you didn't mix classes. I mean, it's kind of the fault in Ever After when she's not allowed to dress like, you know, a higher class person because she is not. But she doesn't, and she's breaking a law. That's what this is. It was a way for the people that had the money to implement their power, to take power over everyone else. And these laws weren't just in Germany, as I mentioned. In the classical world, it was a part of ancient Greece. Here's a quoted example from ancient Greece. A freeborn woman may not be accompanied by more than one female slave unless she is drunk. She may not leave the city during the night unless she is planning to commit adultery. She may not wear gold or a garnet with a purple border unless she is a courtesan. And a husband may not wear a gold-studded ring or a cloak of Milesian fashion unless he is bent upon prostitution or adultery. They exist in ancient Rome. And this one's really good. In ancient Rome, they actually had one of these luxury laws that forbade extravagant expenses at funerals. So they would dictate how you could bury your loved ones based on your class system. There were these laws in China and Japan, in the Islamic world, and then, of course, most notoriously, which ties into Germany, in medieval and Renaissance Europe. Now, here's another good one. So in England specifically, the first major sumptuary act was passed in April of 1463. And scholars have been analyzing this and believe it was really part of a measure to regulate the textile industry. So it was a way to control what people were buying, even back then, from, you know, the government getting involved and basically saying, well, we can, you know, encourage people to buy certain things we want them to buy and not things we don't want them to buy. And this first one will likely make sense to you because we associate the color purple with royalty. It specifically forbade the use of royal purple, which in the Middle Ages also referred to this crimson, dark reds, and royal blues. So no one could wear that unless they were royalty. Then later, another law comes in and restricts cloths of gold and velvet, and you can't wear any satin brocades and certain types of jewelry unless you are a knight or a high lord. Before you know it, there's an extremely long list of items that specify color, materials, the place of manufacture, and you have to follow very specific laws telling you what you can and can't wear and what you can and can't buy. It moved on into France, where Louis XIII in the 1630s decided that only princes and nobility could wear gold embroidery, caps, shirts, collars, and cuffs embroidered with metallic threads and lace. They could only wear puff sleeves, slashes, and bunches of ribbon, and no one else from any other class was allowed to wear it. And believe it or not, America, colonial America did the same thing. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, a 1634 prohibition deemed that only people with a personal fortune of at least £200 could wear lace, silver, or gold thread, or buttons, cutwork, embroidery, hatbands, belts, ruffles, capes, and other specified articles. Fortunately, in colonial America, after only a few decades, people really started defying that and it kind of died out. So again, this is just something unbelievably wild that I can't even fathom existed at one time, but you know what? It makes sense. It's just something I haven't thought about. But luckily, that died out with the class systems, and there's not many class systems left around the world. Anyway, I learned that today while I was in Ulm, and from there we transferred to the Wiblingen Abbey, which has a beautiful Baroque library hall. It's a former Benedictine monastery, and it's famous for its Baroque library hall and the marvelous church that it houses. The highlight of the visit is obviously the library hall, and in there, the decoration of frescoes and sculptures. It has dimensions and lavish furnishings of a banquet hall. Architecture, paintings, sculptures, and decor, and they're all part of a theological and humanities program. So I just have to stop and say this library is just heaven to me. I've never seen anything quite so beautiful. I went to the library in the Strahov Monastery, and it was gorgeous, but you also couldn't go in. And I understand the importance of protecting the site and why they don't want people to go inside, but it's kind of devastating. I don't know, it's just you want to be immersed in that world. So the fact that you can immerse yourself into this library and go inside is really just absolutely breathtaking and incredible. And you walk in and the ceiling is just elaborately painted in these gorgeous scenes from all the way across. There's fake marble. It's not real marble because the structure was actually only made of wood, so it wouldn't support real marble. So they have like a pseudo marble that's a little bit shinier than marble. It's white, that makes up these gorgeous statues of these angels and goddesses all around the different pillars of the library. And then at both ends of the library, you have these circular bookcases that look kind of like a dome that are actually hidden staircases. They're behind them that will take you up to the second floor where you can walk around and you look down from there. The walls are covered in this like pink and blue and gold color, which is really very Baroque, obviously, and just gorgeous. It was unlike anything I've seen before. And one of the journalists on our trip laid down on his back and was just looking up at the art on the floor because it's that consuming. I mean, you go in and it's just this larger than life, gorgeously, elaborately ornate presentation of sculptures and paintings and books, which, I mean, we got to give the books some credit here. There's some incredibly old historical archives here, which is also just, which really just adds to the cultural importance of this site. And again, the fact that we could actually immerse ourselves into this setting in this old monastery was really quite special, and it was definitely a highlight of my trip. I have to say, so far, if I had to pick my favorite thing that I've done, it would be going through Tiefenhole, which I talked about last time, which was that very explorative vertical cave that takes you down these ladder-like stairs all the way to the bottom of this cave system and then back up through these rainy, watery passageways. And The library was also, they scratched both the sweet spots in very distinctively different ways. Like Explorers Club Mallory was all about that Tiefenhold cave, but the cultural anthropologist, the girly Mallory, the one that just loves to read, she was all about that library. It was gorgeous. I could live there. Honestly, I said it in both places, I could spend the night at either of those places and be happy. It would just scratch that itch. So that's pretty much a nutshell on Ulm and the beautiful Baroque monastery library. And, oh yeah, the luxury laws that I found out about that I had to go off on a Mallory tangent on. So it's been a really incredible cultural experience here in Germany so far. Like I said, we went down through the Ice Age Trail, got to see a bunch of artifacts and learn about the anthropology of the Ice Age. And then we got to be transported to Ulm, where we got to see some more of the medieval history, some of the gorgeous religious influence there on the church, and some of the practical cultural applications of some of the most famous landmarks around the city. And then we got to go to the Abbey and experience that beautiful library. So, again, my time in Germany has been incredible so far. I cannot recommend Baden-Württemberg enough. If you are ever in Germany, I have to say the southern part of Germany is definitely my favorite by far. You have these beautiful cultural hotspots in cities like Heidelberg, Baden-Baden. Trier is a great representation of the Roman Empire's footprint left behind in Germany. And then you can keep going into the natural elements out here to these cave systems over in Wimsen and the Swabian Alb. And then you can go to Ulm and kind of see Einstein's footprint and this culture that Ulm just has its self. Like, it's a very distinct culture with its own legends and its own kind of regulations that exist in Ulm. And then to learn about these luxury laws, I mean, that was just the cream of the crop. And yeah, can't recommend it enough. I will continue this podcast again next week, covering more about Germany. I believe it'll be my last one talking about Germany, so I hope you've enjoyed this. I've very much enjoyed getting to share all these experiences with you. And until next week, I hope you all stay weird.